Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump met for the first time last night in Philadelphia. Here are a few headlines. Politico: Harris won the debate and it wasn't close. The New Yorker: Donald Trump had a really, really bad debate. Time Magazine: Trump spent the debate walking into traps Harris laid for him. And New York Times columnist Frank Bruni: Donald Trump made a raving, rambling fool of himself in that debate. The first question was about the economy. Trump transitioned to his usual racist and dangerous talking points about immigration, the border, and crime. Here is Kamala Harris responding.
Well, but I'm going to tell y'all, in this debate tonight, you're going to hear from the same old tired playbook, a bunch of lies, grievances, and name calling. What you're going to hear tonight is a detailed and dangerous plan called Project 2025 that the former president intends on implementing if he were elected again. I believe very strongly that the American people want a president who understands the importance of bringing us together, knowing we have so much more in common than what separates us. And I pledge to you to be a president for all Americans.
President Trump, I'll give you a minute here to respond.
Number one, I have nothing to do, as you know, and as she knows better than anyone, I have nothing to do with Project 2025. That's out there. I haven't read it. I don't want to read it purposely. I'm not going to read it. This was a group of people that got together. They came up with some ideas, I guess some good, some bad. But it makes no difference. I have nothing to do. Everybody knows I'm an open book. Everybody knows what I'm going to do. Cut taxes very substantially and create a great economy like I did before. We had the greatest economy. We got hit with a pandemic. And the pandemic was not since 1917, where 100 million people died, has there been anything like it. We did a phenomenal job with the pandemic. We handed them over a country where the economy and where the stock market was higher than it was before the pandemic came in. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. We made ventilators for the entire world. We got gowns, we got masks, we did things that nobody thought possible. And people give me credit for rebuilding the military. They give me credit for a lot of things, but not enough credit for the great job we did with the pandemic. But the only jobs they got were bounce back jobs. These were jobs bounced back, and it bounced back and it went to their benefit. But I was the one that created them. They know it, and so does everybody else.
Vice President Harris, I'll let you respond.
So Donald Trump has no plan for you. And when you look at his economic plan, it's all about tax breaks for the richest people. I am offering what I describe as an opportunity economy. And the best economists in our country, if not the world, have reviewed our relative plans for the future of America. What Goldman Sachs has said is that Donald Trump's plan would make the economy worse, mine would strengthen the economy. What the Wharton School has said is Donald Trump's plan would actually explode the deficit. 16 Nobel laureates have described his economic plan as something that would increase inflation and by the middle of next year would invite a recession. You just have to look at where we are and where we stand on the issues, and I'd invite you to know that Donald Trump actually has no plan for you because he is more interested in defending himself than he is in looking out for you.
CNN senior reporter Daniel Dale said Donald Trump gave a staggeringly dishonest debate performance. He made at least 33 false claims compared to Kamala Harris making one false claim. And again, we have to say these things because this is what the Republican presidential candidate is saying to millions of people on stage. He once again repeated the lie about babies being executed after birth and the dangerous lie about Haitians eating people's pets in Springfield, Ohio. ABC moderators David Muir and Lindsay Davis did a great job fact-checking Donald Trump. Thanks to Now This for this clip.
In the past couple of weeks leading up to this debate, you have said, quote, you lost by a whisker, that you, quote, didn't quite make it, that you came up a little bit short. Are you now acknowledging that you lost in 2020?
No, I don't acknowledge it at all.
But you
said
did
that
say
sarcastically.
That.
You know that.
I did watch all of these pieces of video. I didn't detect the sarcasm, lost by a whisker, we didn't quite make it. And we should just point out here as clarification, and you know this, you and your allies, 60 cases in front of many judges, many of them
no
Republican.
No judge looked at it.
And said
they
there was
said
no
we didn't have standing.
Fraud.
In Springfield, They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
I just want to clarify here. You bring up Springfield, Ohio, and ABC News did reach out to the city manager there. He told us there have been no credible reports of specific claims of pets being harmed, injured, or abused by individuals within the immigrant community.
Well, they have abortion in the ninth month. In other words, we'll execute the baby.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born.
Obamacare was lousy health care. And what we will do is we're looking at different plans. If we can come up with a plan that's going to cost our people, our population, less money and be better health care than Obamacare, then I would absolutely do it.
So just a yes or no, you still do not have a plan?
I have concepts of a plan. I'm not president right now.
And we should say NPR did a piece this morning about the pets in Springfield. And the NAACP head of Springfield's chapter, Denise Williams, said she is now getting so many threats. And she says that she is going to keep speaking out against the racism directed toward the Haitian community. And we're going to talk more about that during today's show, because as we always talk about, these words have consequences. So what did you make of the debate, what we heard last night, and what is at stake? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joining us are two guests. Michelle Goodwin is professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown, host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin at Ms. Magazine, and author of four books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Hi, Professor Goodwin. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, co-founder of DCReport.org, author of four bestsellers, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family, and is professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Congratulations, Professor Johnston. David, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Rose. Always glad to be on with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Great to have both of you. Michelle, let's start off with you. What were your overall thoughts about last night's debate?
Well, there are a few. So overall, the moderators attempted to do a great job in light of the candidates that they had in front of them. And here I'm talking about the fact that the former president spoke more at a certain point. I think it was, 10 minutes more. Because of add-ons and being able to conclude questions. We saw a person who was really unstable. And as reporters have shown, there are ways in which Kamala Harris, the vice president, was able to do a bit of trolling. And it was easy for Donald Trump to fall into certain kinds of patterns, including spending time talking about the size of crowds at his rallies and things like that. We saw two different visions for the United States, one in which the vice president frequently reminded the listening and viewing audience that she's very much concerned about addressing the concerns of poverty, the middle class, and unifying Americans at a time in which there's so much disunity. And on the other hand, we saw considerable denialism by the former president, Donald Trump, and a number of times in which he was either fact-checked or there were just blatant falsities, including, again, with the 2020 election and the claim that he won or that there were judges that somehow failed to rule accordingly, didn't rule on the substance of law. But there were more than 60 different cases that he lost where consistently across the country there were courts, and including some where he had actually nominated those judges that said that it was a fair election and that he lost the 2020 presidency. One last thing that I'll add to that, just as an overall, it was interesting to see that given the E. Jean Carroll case and along with other claims of sexual assault, that still isn't a case, a question that is put forward to Donald Trump. It wasn't on the agenda last night, although the vice president did raise that as an issue.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Every time this comes up, I just think back to that tape that we heard, and then all of the lawsuits, the sexual assault allegations against Trump in addition to those lawsuits. What about you, David? What stood out for you last night?
Well, for the first time, Donald had to deal with someone at length where he couldn't run away, as he routinely does with reporters, who was able to understand that Donald is a con artist, that he's appallingly ignorant, he's a misogynist, he's a racist. And her 18 years of experience as a trial prosecutor in Alameda County came through. She never took the bait. She slipped away from questions that there's no reason to answer them that will help you in any way. And she let Donald go on. He hogged the time, but he was hanging himself as he did so. And I thought one of the most revealing moments was when David Muir called him on the issue of Haitian immigrants supposedly kidnapping and then eating dogs and cats in Springfield, Ohio. And Donald comes back and says, I saw a man say it on television. That screams how shallow Donald is, how appallingly ignorant he is. And it's something, you know, for 36 years, I've been trying to get people to understand. And last night, I felt like finally somebody not only gets it, but they understand how to bring this out. He had a terrible, terrible night. If you go to the websites of people like Eric Erickson and others on the right, they're livid. They're trying to blame other people. But of course, that's a standard Donald tactic. Remember that Donald was once asked, you know, well, as a Christian, Mr. Trump, when was the last time you asked God for forgiveness? And Donald said, ask for forgiveness? I've never asked anyone for forgiveness in my life. I've never done a single thing that would require asking forgiveness. She brought forth the kind of thing that tells you what a shallow person with no regard for anyone else Donald is.
To your point, David, I saw that you retweeted Eric Erickson's tweet. He's a far right. He's got a radio show and a lot of followers. And he tweeted in caps, "You stupid MFers just got Trump to repeat your lie about the pets. Congrats on setting the news stories tomorrow by lying so Trump picks it up and says stupid S-H-I-T. David, you have been covering Trump for how long?
It was 36 years, and it was 36 years ago I was the first person to write about him potentially becoming president.
Wow. So what do you think explains this repeating? I mean, we can say it's so ridiculous. There's all these memes online, but it's also very dangerous. I'll read a statement from the Haitian American Foundation for Democracy in a minute. Why do you think he's doing that? And then given that you know him so well, how do you think his supporters are going to respond to last night? And then I'm hearing that there are still people who are undecided.
Well, I think that Donald damaged himself deeply last night. That doesn't mean that Vice President Harris necessarily will benefit from this. I doubt he will lose any of the hardcore supporters because, as I've explained on your show before, you know, those are people who they hate the civil rights movement. They hate a whole bunch of other things in America, and many of them are faux Christians who preach hate, not the message of the New Testament of love. And Donald did reveal himself to be so ignorant. That's been one of the things I've been waiting for. Every time I read an article in my former newspaper, the New York Times, about Donald's policy. What policy? There's no policy in Donald. Everything is done by the seat of the pants. And he's a con artist. He's been a criminal his entire life. So there's no policy there. And 9 years after he came down the Trump Tower escalator, he still doesn't have a health care plan. I have concepts of plans. What more do people need to know that he is a fraud? He's utterly incompetent. And he couldn't even look Kamala Harris in the eye last night. A real sign of his disregard for her, in part because of her race, in part because she's a woman, and in part because She's competent and knows what she's doing, unlike Donald.
And of course, Professor Goodwin, he has said just the nastiest things about Kamala Harris, like he always does about people, but especially because she's a woman and a woman of color. What are your thoughts on that and how that aspect has been covered in the media?
Well, the media has done a very poor job of this. You know, keep in mind that in the 2016 election, by that point, there had already been a lawsuit that was alleging that a 13-year-old, a person who, when she was 13 years old, was taken to Jeffrey Epstein's home for a sexual engagement with Donald Trump and that she had been raped. It was a lawsuit. It was a lawsuit that had allowed, that was allowed to go forward. And there was very limited news coverage of it. So little that even today, there are people who say, really? Was that there? And of course, in the space in between 2016 and 2024, we know so much about Jeffrey Epstein and the kind of horror place that he maintained, where so many girls were physically, sexually assaulted by him and many others. Donald Trump was a friend of Jeffrey Epstein's and spent time at his home. It raises significant questions because it was a lawsuit that had been filed and that was allowed to go forward before this young woman disappeared. And so there has been very limited news coverage of the sexual assault allegations, even post E. Jean Carroll, not sufficient engagement in these questions. And Americans actually deserve so much better than this. But there's been so much in the way in which Donald Trump has been able to escape from significant scrutiny in debates and otherwise in non-debate settings, even in the ways in which headlines are framed. It's really quite stunning to see just the difference, and more specifically what it means in terms of the way in which he's talked about Kamala Harris. Well, he's talked about her in demeaning ways, in ways in which he should be embarrassed, and in ways in which others who surround him and his camp should be embarrassed. But these are ways in which he's talked about women in general, which leads you to the point of view that he's a person that doesn't actually have much regard or respect for women at all. He has talked about how he purposely handpicked three justices who would come onto the Supreme Court and others who would do away with reproductive freedom. And what that has meant in the time since the Dobbs decision is that we've seen little girls now going into elementary school as mothers. Mm. We have seen women who wanted to be pregnant but had miscarriages forced to flee states or bleeding out in parking lots. We've seen, because of the Donald Trump abortion plan, which is pretty much what Kamala Harris called it last night, the vice president, we've seen women having to be airlifted out of Idaho in order to get the kind of health care that they need. Those who've wanted to be pregnant, suffering, little girls now going into elementary school as mothers. And that's just a slice of the repercussions of Donald Trump and his agenda for women. And to the point that Professor Johnston was just making, as a person who doesn't actually have a plan, but a concept of a plan, the one area where it's clear that Donald Trump did have a plan was in ridding reproductive freedom from the United States. And the results have been absolutely catastrophic and devastating, both in terms of maternal mortality, maternal morbidity, what this has meant for people who have experienced rape and incest. It really is, in so many ways, what we see unfolding, a true crime against humanity in the United States. And that's not an exaggeration, considering just the harm that's been caused by the one plan that he is able to articulate.
Professor Goodwin, since you brought up Jeffrey Epstein and the 13-year-old girl, I hadn't heard about this until it came up again in the last few months. So I did some reading, and I found this piece at Vox by Emily Crockett, November 2016. The lawsuit accusing Trump of raping a 13-year-old girl explained. The anonymous plaintiff dropped her suit against Trump, the circumstances around which have been bizarre. Emily Crockett reports that Lisa Bloom, a high-profile civil rights attorney who was heading a lot of these cases and representing these girls and women, told a room full of reporters that the 13-year-old was afraid to show her face, or the former 13-year-old Johnson was afraid to show her face after receiving multiple death threats and that they'd have to reschedule. And then Bloom announced that she dropped the lawsuit altogether.
Yes. Well, between, as you talked about earlier, the Donald Trump being caught on hot mic talking about how he likes to grab women, how you're able to get away with it when you're a celebrity, which is something that he repeated in deposition during the E. Jean Carroll case. And that, I mean, it is so powerful to think about how that moment was lost, how it was overlooked. And so many who experience rape and sexual subordination are fearful. But can you imagine what it means for a 13-year-old girl, like many of the 13-year-old girls who had been subjected to Jeffrey Epstein, coming from backgrounds where they happened to be vulnerable? There was an affidavit that was signed in that case by a person who said that she had actually recruited, found this vulnerable girl at 13 and took her to Jeffrey Epstein. So those girls were poor, they were vulnerable, they came from complicated family situations. And then you juxtapose that against a person who says that he's a multi-billionaire, that he has billions and billions of dollars, that he has influence amongst people who are authoritarians and so forth. How do you stand up to that? How does a woman who had a fragile beginning as a child stand up against someone that says, I have all power, all resources, all money on my side? And this is part of why it was so important for journalists to do a good job at that time. And they failed significantly. And I think for any future debate that doesn't raise these questions, it's also a failure.
David, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I totally agree with everything that Professor Goodwin has said about this and the absolute failure by our major news organizations to scrub Donald. In the fall of 16, I tried very hard to get people to dig into Donald. And one of the things I pushed very hard was there is robust evidence that Donald Trump was in the cocaine trafficking business at a very high level. There's a long court record. There's a confession by the trafficker, a twice convicted, now three-time convicted felon. There's a letter Donald wrote, and there's the bizarre circumstance in which the case was moved from Cincinnati, Ohio, not to New York or Miami, as it was supposed to be, but to the courtroom of Judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald's sister. And that the favors Donald did for his partner make no sense whatsoever, especially for a man with a casino license who's under strict rules about who he consorts with, unless they were in the cocaine business together, in which case everything Donald did makes absolutely perfect sense. And in when I was teaching law at Syracuse, I would address this case and talk about it in terms of what evidence tells you. No journalist other than me and the late, great Wayne Barrett has written, one or two others maybe in small places, has written about this despite the robust public record of it. And there are many things about Donald's life that have not been looked into. The attack on E. Jean Carroll, where he was judicially determined by a federal judge to have met the standard of rape in New York State, and the more than two dozen women who've come forward, that's gotten almost no attention. And I blame this heavily on the New York Times. It's still the greatest newspaper in the world, but there's a blind spot here, and I know where it comes from because I've talked to my former editors. As one of them said to me when I said, you guys really got to scrub Donald, you got to really dig into the, this is in 2016, into the connections with the drug trafficker and a bunch of other things I pointed out, like plying 13-year-old girl with liquor because she had money to gamble and giving her limousine rides and hotel suites. The answer I got was, well, everybody knows Donald Trump is a complete fraud. And I said, no, everybody in Manhattan knows that. People in Iowa and Texas watching his TV show who have no idea how business operates think he's a business genius, and they think he's a billionaire when he's not now and never has been a billionaire. It's all fraud. And he brags in his books about the frauds he committed. So the handling of this by the news media overall has been atrocious, but I mostly blame the New York Times because every significant news editor and newspaper editor, TV producer and news starts their day by looking at what's in the New York Times for guidance. And when the Times falls down, the whole system tends to fall down.
Wow. Well, and David, just a couple of days ago, you had Trump publicly lashing out at the women who've accused him of sexual assault, while his lawyers are just sitting there staring at him.
Yes, and understand that Donald really believes, as I've written going back many, many years, he really believes that he is unique on the planet. He shouldn't just run the U.S., he should run the whole world. All the rest of us were idiots. We have no idea what we're doing. Look at how he denounced his own staff, the people who've turned on him, who are four-star generals and respected longtime public servants. And he goes, oh, they were bad people. I shouldn't have hired them. I'm sorry, you're the guy who said I only hire the best. And this is a deep form of mental illness. And I would remind readers that Bandy Lee, the Yale psychiatry professor who was fired for talking about Donald's mental illness and how there is a social equivalent of infectious spread of his mental illness, I was the only person who would publish her for 6 years. I published about 40 stories by and about her. Nobody else would touch her. And yet anyone who watched the debate last night should be able to see Donald is deeply mentally ill. I'm not in a position to diagnose exactly what his mental illness is, but you don't need a medical degree or a psychiatric or psychological degree to notice that Donald Trump is not mentally well.
We're going to take a quick break. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who has covered Donald Trump for 36 years. He's written four bestsellers, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. He's the co-founder of DCReport.org and professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Michelle Goodwin is professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown, host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin at Ms. Magazine, and author of four books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. If you'd like to join us, what did you think of the debate last night and what you heard, and also what is at stake in this election? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with climate journalist Jeff Dembicki about the debate and what is at stake in the upcoming election. The climate crisis was asked about toward the end of the debate. Unfortunately, it just didn't get the time it deserved. And the answers really didn't tell us much. Of course, we know that if Donald Trump goes back to the White House, it is game over for the climate at the federal level. Climate scientists say we have to act by 2030. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown, host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin, and author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who's covered Trump for 36 years. He's co-founder of DCReport.org, author of The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. He's also a professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Well, to be fair, since we spent a lot of time talking about Trump in the first half of the show, let's play a compilation of Kamala Harris speaking at last night's debate.
Donald Trump was fired by 81 million people. So let's be clear about that. And clearly he is having a very difficult time processing that. World leaders are laughing at Donald Trump. I have talked with military leaders, some of whom worked with you, and they say you're a disgrace. It's important to remind the former president, you're not running against Joe Biden, you're running against me. The alliances we have around the world are dependent on our ability to look out for our friends and not favor our enemies because you adore strongmen instead of caring about democracy. I'm going to actually do something really unusual, and I'm going to invite you to attend one of Donald Trump's rallies, because it's a really interesting thing to watch. You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom. And I will tell you, the one thing you will not hear him talk about is you. I absolutely support reinstating the protections of Roe v. Wade. And as you rightly mentioned, nowhere in America is a woman carrying a pregnancy to term and asking for an abortion. That is not happening. It's insulting to the women of America. And understand what has been happening under Donald Trump's abortion bans. Couples who pray and dream of having a family are being denied IVF treatments. What is happening in our country? Working people, working women, who are working one or two jobs, who can barely afford childcare as it is, have to travel to another state to get on a plane sitting next to strangers, to go and get the health care she needs. Barely can afford to do it, and what you are putting her through is unconscionable. And the people of America have not, the majority of Americans believe in a woman's right to make decisions about her own body. And that is why in every state where this issue has been on the ballot, in red and blue states both, the people of America have voted for freedom.
Kamala Harris has spent a few years traveling across the country, talking to women and families about how they have been affected by Trump's abortion bans. Professor Goodwin, Democrats have not been very good on this issue. Joe Biden has been very uncomfortable with this issue. This is really one of the first times to see such a high-profile Democrat talk about abortion and bring out these stories with so much passion. And we know that more people than ever are now pro-choice, post-Dobbs. What are your thoughts about that? And I mean, I just read a story about how conservative women in Florida, this is not surprising to people who pay attention to this closely, but conservative women in Florida are voting for that amendment to ensure that abortion remains legal in Florida. Professor Goodwin?
Yes.
Oh, sorry about that.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
So my book, Policing the Womb, which was published in 2020, 2 years before the Dobbs decision, was predictive of Dobbs. By that point, I had spent over 20 years writing about here's what's going to be coming. And if a person like Donald Trump is placed in office, here is what will take place. And the book concluded talking about sexual assaults and violence and the kind of violence that we could see coming ahead. It's not surprising that Kamala Harris has been committed to these issues. When she was in California as the state's attorney general, these were issues that also were on the surface for her in meaningful ways, not just at the top of the surface, but in deep and meaningful ways, as she tells the narrative about having a friend when she was a young person who had been sexually assaulted and learning about that. It was part of a guide in her life. That was a friend who came to live with her. Before the Dobbs decision was released by the Supreme Court, I was one of six professors who met with her at the White House to talk about the potentiality of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. I think that for many Democrats, they were complacent, just as they were complacent about the courts. This idea that democracy is here, it will stay, reproductive rights are here, stay. To give you some idea as to why some of that complacency might be understood, though it was wrongheaded. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg was going through her confirmation hearing, she had only a few no votes, and she talked frequently about abortion. She didn't hide from it at all. She talked about it over and over again. So to some extent, Democrats probably really thought that there is no way that the right to be able to govern your own reproductive health care will go away. But they were wrong. They were not paying close attention. They were not paying attention to the movements that were taking afoot, even though Roe v. Wade was a 7-2 opinion. And of those seven justices, five were Republican appointed. And Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion in Roe, was put on the court by Richard Nixon. And no one would confuse Richard Nixon with being a bleeding heart liberal. But that said, the vice president has done an outstanding job in terms of resonating with the American people and American women, Republican, Independent, and Democrat, in terms of what they think about these issues. In 2022, before the midterm elections, when people were asking me, including journalists, whether the red tsunami was actually going to take place, I said no over and over again. And they looked at me astonished because what pundits had said. And what you saw was a real failure to connect a question on economics as being a question for women in the frame of family planning. What people didn't get is that immediately after Dobbs, there was a little girl who had to flee Ohio to get to Indiana after being raped and being pregnant in order for that pregnancy to be terminated. And what they were failing to understand is that any mother, Republican, Democrat, Independent, undecided, who sits across the dinner table looking at her children, looking at her daughter, that mother cares more about her daughter and her daughter's ability to have a life that is flourishing than some lawmaker in the state that says, we demand that she becomes a mother at 11 if she becomes pregnant. And so the vice president understands that. And I think that's been part of the movement that she's made. And I think that that's been part of what we see, including in Florida, amongst Republican women saying, you know, their daughters matter, they matter, their nieces matter. And this is, at the end of the day, basic healthcare.
David, what are your thoughts on this, given that we're hearing so much about the economy, as we should, but what about the connections between abortion bans and the economy, given that these bans are hitting low-income women and girls and women of color the most?
Well, all the writing that I've done for going back now more than 30 years, documenting our growing inequality, the books I've written about it and the articles, one of the clear messages in this is that white males dominate in terms of economic success and power everywhere you look, without exception. And it shouldn't in some ways be surprising that people who have privilege don't want to give it up. In some ways, I think it's astonishing that men voted for the changes at the state level and the amendment, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, that gave women the right to vote that I, plain reading of the 14th Amendment, says that they got in the 1870s. But you have to look at all of this in the broad context of American culture and how people internalize things. The polling after the infamous Billy Bush tape, where Trump bragged about sexual assault, showed an increase in support from Trump among some women. And at first blush, it's like, what? How can that be? But if you've internalized misogyny, then that would sort of make sense. And in our society, it isn't just Donald Trump. It's governors and state lawmakers and men who have no idea about women's biology and who've never been in the situation of being asked by a doctor when your spouse is so drugged up she can't make any decisions, if we have to choose, whose life do we save, the child or the mother? And trust me, that's not something you don't do without deep thought. We need to recognize that Donald Trump is part of a past that Kamala Harris is saying, let's get past this. Let's move into a future. And let's stop putting government between anyone, but especially women and their doctors. It's none of the government's business. And then Donald lying and saying, you know, we kill babies after they're born. That on its face should tell you how unfit he is and how full of hate towards women as a class that he is. Donald sees all of us as objects. We're not human beings. He has no empathy. He has no connection to us. We're objects, either in my case, as someone to overcome, in most people's cases, to either use or abuse. But he doesn't see everyone else as people, which is terrible for him, by the way. I feel terrible for Donald for the empty life that he's lived. I call it the Groundhog Day nightmare. He's been trapped in being a 13-year-old boy now for more than 65 years. Mm. And it is a fundamental message of Kamala Harris that we need to get beyond this division, hatred, disrespect, and develop a society of regard, of opportunity, and of keeping the government out of things that aren't the government's business.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter who has covered Donald Trump for 36 years. He is professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology, co-founder of DCReport.com, author of four bestsellers, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. Michelle Goodwin is professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown, host of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin at Ms. Magazine, and the author of four books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. We have some callers who've been waiting so patiently. Thank you so much. Let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Well, thank you. I wanted to point something out, which I think people are overlooking, and I think Ms. Harris did a tremendous job in staying focused. And that is, most of the voters really don't care one hoot about what Donald's past is, what his present is, and what he even may do. He has hit on what he understands their response to being in anger for their conditions that they're in, not feeling that they don't have any thing to do about it or anything they have to change it, which we know they do, but irrespective, they don't believe it. And finally, he said, simple. I can resolve your problem, which is most important, immediately, in 24 hours, because he does recognize that so many voters don't really want to hear, oh, well, it'll take me a month, 2 months, 3 months, a year, 2 years to correct large issues, which would take that amount of time to adequately address the issue. They want to hear, you get my anger and you'll fix it tomorrow, because that's how they perceive life. So by her staying on focus on what she was doing, she kept the focus on, he's not going to be that person to address your anger. He's not going to be the person to fix it immediately. She just kept staying focused on that. And I think that was her big triumph.
Well, thank you so much, Robert. Let's take another call and some emails, and then we'll get our guests to respond. Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, good morning, Rose, and good morning, your guests. Hey, the story that Trump was relating to Fox News in Springfield, Ohio, would there be any recourse for the city of Springfield to do a cease and desist or ask for a correction on that from Fox News so people get the truth? And my second question is, the mistake of fact that Kamala Harris made, I believe it had to do with the bloodbath term. When I heard Trump use that term, it was used in the context of the Chinese electrical vehicle market being let into the United States, and the bloodbath meaning the loss of market share by U.S. EV manufacturers. Is that true? Is that where that bloodbath term actually, the context of it is? Thanks.
Thank you so much. So let's take Springfield first. I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to go back to this. The Haitian American Foundation for Democracy put out a statement saying, the simple truth is that towns like Springfield, Ohio, whose economy were in decline, have been revitalized by the influx of Haitian and other legal immigrants. As these communities adjust to demographic changes, this transitional period should be viewed as an opportunity for growth and collaboration, not for sowing confusion and fear. We urge all Haitian Americans and our allies to counter these vile attacks by actively engaging in the democratic process, promoting inclusivity. What are your thoughts on this, Professor Goodwin? Because people are very armed in this country. And I mean, I'm really upset that guns did not come up. I mean, my 14-year-old niece was once again afraid to go to school because of the shooting in Georgia. I mean, my brother has to deal with this constantly. It's just horrible what children and their families are dealing with today. So I'm shocked that guns did not come up at the debate. But what are your thoughts about this dangerous rhetoric? And J.D. Vance is doubling down on this.
It's a horrific rhetoric. Let's just be clear. It's a rhetoric that's part of a dog whistle and the kind of dog whistling that sadly predates Jim Crow, that has its legacies in American slavery and also colonialism. We know this. It's empirically true, even though people may not be aware or may be resistant to knowing this, right? This idea of Black people being savages, indigenous people being savages, that somehow they have different brain capacities, you know, intestinally they're different, their genitalia is different, right? It goes on and on through American eugenics. And that kind of dog whistling is meant to send a signal that it is okay to treat people from those communities, those othered communities, those communities of color, in ways that are shamefully harmful, in ways that are even violent. You know, the history of lynching in the United States, the histories of violence and brutality against communities of color, all come out of this dog whistling. And interestingly enough, there's a lot of dog whistling that's associated with race and with food, right? We saw that even during the period of COVID, again with Donald Trump. And we saw just an outgrowth of violence against people who are Asian American in the United States, including with having acid thrown on them, children being beaten up at school, being spat upon, all of this with associations about, well, what do Asian people eat, right? And so it's inflammatory rhetoric. It's rhetoric that's rooted in racism. It's rhetoric that inspires violence. And it's rhetoric that then means there must be protections for people who experience this. And to your point about guns and not guns not coming up, in a society where we have seen the amplification of mass shootings, primarily carried out against young white men in our society, is also something that connects to what Professor Johnston has been talking about with Donald Trump. And that is the way in which he's been able to wield his privilege. He's been able to wield this privilege as a white man in our society. And that whether he has these billions or not, it is how he projects that that makes people stand back and stand down.
Mm. And just quickly on the bloodbath, because we're almost out of time and I'd love to get final thoughts from our guests. So last night, Kamala Harris said, Donald Trump, the candidate, has said in this election, there will be a bloodbath if the outcome of the election is not to his liking. She was referring to comments Trump made at a rally in Ohio in March. I'm reading from NBC right now. At the rally, Trump vowed there would be a bloodbath if he's not elected in November. Comments that came during a broader tirade that included his referring to the possibility of an increasing trade war with China over auto manufacturing. So the thing is, sometimes he doesn't even stop when he speaks, so it's all kind of jumbled together. But it was part of a larger tirade. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm sorry to go through this so quickly, but I do want to get your final thoughts. We keep hearing every single day that the polls are so close, it's neck and neck. Do you believe that? Why, and these are big questions, but we have a couple of minutes. Why do you think Trump still has so much support? Just to remind everyone, last election, he did get 74 million votes. And then what is at stake in this election? I know that's a lot, but take 2 minutes and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Why don't you go first, David?
Well, Donald has support from the three basic groups of people. The economic support comes from 50 years of policies that have disregarded ordinary people, the destruction of unions, and the stealth programs that I spent years exposing that silently and unseen take money from your and my pockets and redistribute it to people at the top. There's hundreds of them that I've exposed scores of them. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of them. So there's a serious legitimate anger about how our governments have not been responding to ordinary people. That's not going to go away. I don't trust the poll numbers at all because fewer than 1 in 100 people who answer their phone are taking the questions, according to the pollster John Geraci. And he says no matter what the crosstabs say, you're not getting a reliable random sample of people. And finally, this is about the Electoral College. There are only 7 states that are going to matter in this election, and Kamala Harris is being very smart. She and Walz are going primarily to five of those states because of this racist holdover from the 18th century called the Electoral College.
David, do you think that it's responsible for the media to tell us all day, every day, that this race is razor thin close?
Well, if that's what the data that people have, I mean, I'm not a favorite fan of polls and surveys. And when I was very young, I made extra money doing polls and learned how easy it is to manipulate the subjects. Because human beings are largely herd animals, so you can easily direct people in subtle ways. They want to appeal to you. The same thing detectives use to get people to commit to confess to crimes they didn't commit. I wish we would focus on policy and not on the horse race. And I wish we'd stop saying political reporters, they're politics reporters.
Yes, thank you. And Professor Goodwin, your thoughts? We have about 90 seconds left.
Well, I will say that we need to diversify what we think about in terms of pollsters and who's doing the polling and so forth. At Ms. Magazine, we've worked with Celinda Lake, and we had very different predictions in 2022 in terms of the midterm than other pollsters did. What we had and what we were sharing is that it's not going to be a red tsunami based on the data that we were the data that we got from the kind of research that we were doing. But let's be clear in terms of what's at stake here. The vice president has mentioned our democracy is at stake. The ability for us to be unified in this country is at stake. And there's some other things that I think really touch the hearts and minds of Americans. The ability to be able to actually take a walk and not have the weight of the world on your shoulders. Mm. The kind of thing that people can remember 10 years ago, being able to do, just walk down a street and just be able to look up at the sky. After 4 years of Trump in office with Muslim bans, kids locked in cages, sending members of lawyers from the DOJ to argue before judges that kids don't deserve soap and toothpaste while they're in U.S. detention, the surveillance of girls in their periods who are in detention, all of those things that cause such a fear that when your inbox said breaking news, I think Americans really did feel the psychological fragility of that during the Trump years. That's what's at stake. As you mentioned, guns, right? And killings at schools. That's what's at stake. It's where we are, not just as a democracy, but where we are as human beings in the United States.
Professors Michelle Goodwin and David K. Johnston, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.